Before we get going with today's program, I just want to mention a few things about our new members' website. The address that you should bookmark is www.redeyesmembers.com. Go there from now on as a member to listen to all radio programs in their entirety and enjoy all the other content there as well. It's linked up from redeyescreations.com as well, if you just click on the members button. But I just want to make you aware that if you are a member with an active subscription, please go to redeyesmembers.com and from there click into any program to log in and stream or download. One of the new features that I'd just briefly like to explain is that we now have all hours on one program page instead of two pages as we had before. So this means if a program is two or more hours, you'll find all the download links on the same program page. Also in the player, if you use our player, all these segments or hours are now linked up within the player. So when 1 hour finishes, the next hour automatically begins. It's very simple. But you can also click skip forward or backward in the player to go to the next or previous hour. So to make it simple for you as a member, again, remember to go to redeyesmembers.com and download or stream from there. It's a slightly different routine, but I think much easier once you get the hang of it. And also, I would like to mention that I know quite a few of you out there as members are enjoying the RSS feeds as well. And no, we have not removed these, not at all. In fact, we have made them much better. You need to go to the new members website and click on the RSS icon at the top right from any page to get access to the new feeds. There's also an RSS help page linked up from there as well. And just overall here, don't forget about our FAQ. We have the most common issues and potential snags detailed there. So please take some time to go through this if you have questions. And since it's a new website with new features and new routines, we appreciate your help in making this transition nice and smooth as well. Thank you very much for your help. Hello friends and dear listeners, welcome back to Red Eyes Radio. If you're a new listener, say warm welcome as well. I'm Henrik Palmgren, thank you for tuning in today. I hope you're enjoying your stay on this planet Earth and find some time to do something fun and enjoy yourself and relax a bit among all the craziness and madness. Don't forget to take some time to look at the details, read the fine print now and then. So many are running around with no clue about where they are, what they're doing, or what it's all about. So amongst this confusion, we are trying to highlight topics and research that hopefully could help to clear up some of the confusion and answer some of the questions. We talk with researchers who have studied many of the areas that we cover in great depth, and they might have some thoughts and ideas that could be beneficial to you. This, of course, as always, doesn't mean we have to agree with all they say or what they propose, but hopefully it will help us to think about new things, consider an aspect we might not have thought about before, or simply to re-examine the things that we believe. Today we're talking with Bill Still. He is a former newspaper editor and publisher, best-selling author and award-winning documentary writer and director. He has written 20 books, including his latest, No More National Debt. He has also produced 3 feature-length documentaries. This includes The Money Masters and The Secret of Oz that we're going to discuss today. This won the 2010 award for Best Documentary at the Belois International Film Festival. Bill has written articles for USA Today, the Saturday Evening Post, the Los Angeles Times Syndicate, and Omni Magazine. And today we're going to focus on the myths of the monetary system, how we ended up in the financial quagmire we're in right now, and how a potential reform of the monetary system could look. Right, welcome to the program, Bill Still. Looking forward to this one. I saw your Money Masters documentary many years ago now, one of the best documentaries on the subject, I think. So this is going to be very exciting. Thank you for coming on the program, first of all.
Oh, boy, it's my pleasure. I always like dealing with Swedes and had a great time when I was in Stockholm a couple years ago.
Was that where you were filming for The Secrets of Oz as well? I saw some footage from up Stockholm, I believe.
Oh, yeah. We filmed all around the Inner Harbor there. That was I didn't realize Stockholm was the Venice of Scandinavia. It's just incredibly beautiful.
A lot of archipelagos. What's a few years ago since I was up there now? I need to revisit there. Were you there in the summertime, I guess?
Well, no, it seems like I never get out until October. So.
Oh, that's a bummer. Well, in any regard, it's lovely and with the archipelagos and everything out there. Now, this is a big subject, of course, we're going to talk about today. Your films, your work overall on the economic system, the monetary system and everything else. And maybe it's a little bit difficult to know where to begin, but maybe we can just briefly talk about you, Bill, how you, I guess, got into this and just give us a little bit of an outline here in the beginning.
Yeah, well, I was I started out life as a newspaper reporter and then ended up owning my own newspaper and publishing it. This was in the late 70s, early 80s. And subsequently, I've written for USA Today, the Saturday Evening Post, the Los Angeles Times Syndicate, written 20 books, produced The Money Masters in 1995, the 15th most watched film in internet history, The Secret of Oz in 2010, which won Best Documentary of 2010 at one international film festival. And my latest book is called No More National Debt, which was published last year. And that pretty much brings us up to where we are.
And globally, we're kind of in a mess. Now, what would you say to someone who has a point of view that the monetary system overall is just way too complicated for anybody to understand? We have hundreds, if not hundreds of thousands of people around the globe working on this, the brightest mind around the world trying to fix the crisis that began in 2008, the most recent one, and basically that no one really can understand what's going on. It's like a big mystery here. What would you say to that, Bill?
I'd say that that's an impression deliberately generated by those who deliberately make a profit into the trillions of dollars per year. They can easily afford to spend a few billion here and there to try to keep the population confused, to try to keep them thinking that this is way too complicated for the average person to comprehend, much less critique. It's not difficult at all. The basic problem is, number one, governments are borrowing money primarily from banks. Number two, banks are allowed to counterfeit the national money through a system called fractional reserve lending. If you don't get anything else out of that interview, if you get this much, then you comprehend the totality of what both the problem and the solution are.
And an obvious question to that is then, why is it that the people in charge or seemingly in charge don't get this? Why don't they talk about this?
Well, it's well known in economic circles that any economist who breathes the term monetary reform will never get on a tenure track at a university and essentially would be shunned by the rest of his profession. Economics, the study of economics is supposed to be the study of how to create economic and financial stability in a national system. When in fact, the privately owned central bank system, which began in the late 1600s with the Bank of England, has done nothing but create just the opposite. And that is, it thrives off of calamities and wars. It loves to talk about the business cycle as though it's some inalterable cycle of the movements of the planet Uranus that we can have no control over, when in fact it's not the case at all. The business cycle is simply bubbles artificially created for the benefit of the biggest banks, and when there are artificial money creation becomes too big, it creates a bubble, and then there's a crash. And so these guys also know how to benefit from the crash aspect of it. So they're just, it's just like milking a cow. They're milking the national economies of every nation. And through this thing, they've gotten us to believe that there's something called the business cycle over which no human can possibly have control. And it's just not the case. It's strictly the creation of people who create national monies for their own benefit.
And they've certainly made it their business to benefit, as you say, from the crashes. Now, you have a theory, I guess we can call it, that the global monetary system is revised every, 30 to 40 years or so throughout history. How close are we in that revising of that cycle, if you will, right now, Bill?
Well, no one knows for sure. Anybody who tells you that they know when the next crash is going to come is either deluded or lying, because there are just too many variables going on. I think certainly the euro is doomed. When it will happen, I don't know. They're able, through this very complicated Ponzi scheme, one nation buying the other nation's bonds, and then it's just a completely stupid system that they're trying to do to basically keep the plates spinning for as long as they possibly can. But it's essentially doomed. Despite the fact that they might rearrange the debts to make it look like it's okay for a little while, the interest on these debts continues to grow geometrically, and it's way past the point of sustainability now. It's just a question of when it goes, not if it goes.
I've always wondered if this is the intention to begin with, because there is, as you said before, a very beneficial, it's beneficial to them, the fact that they can benefit when we have a crash in different ways. We've seen this in history as well. I remember in the Money Masters, you did an excellent job of this example of the battle of between Wellington and Napoleon, and how one of the Rothschilds there in London basically benefited from this. Is this how they still run the game? Is this the same MO, if you will?
Well, yeah, basically. I'm not sure that there's one guy who sits at the pinnacle of all this and says, okay, today we're taking the market down. I'm not sure that that's the case, but certainly the folks on the inside can see the signs when it's about to let loose, and they can get on the correct side of the trade. Incidentally, you spoke about Wellington and Napoleon, the Battle of Waterloo. When I go over to Denmark to speak next month, I'm also going to swing by Waterloo, and I'm going to recount that tale, and we'll be filming it in 3D for a new documentary project I have underway, which is called Jekyll Island and concerns the 1910 meeting between the forces of Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, and the other titans of American industry, when they were trying to figure out how to contrive a banking legislation that the American Congress would accept, which turned out to be the Federal Reserve System. It's a very interesting aspect of American history, and I'm going to focus on that period, 1907 to 1915, and we'll have it out hopefully by the end of the year.
Really good. Wow, that's interesting. The Federal Reserve is a big subject. I hope we can get into that more later. Now, you've made a study of history as well. I don't think we can you know, or talk about the topic of economy without looking back into history. Are there some of the highlights that you like to say when you look back into history? Are there examples from there? I mean, you bring up some of them in The Secret of Oz, your new film, that talks about some of the systems that have been in operation throughout the years that actually worked for a brief period. Maybe we can talk about a few of them, Bill.
Well, yeah, you're probably talking about, first and foremost, would be the English system that created essentially the conditions which allowed the British Empire to expand to the extent it did. I mean, remember, England is a very small island with very few natural resources, and yet at one point, Britannica ruled the waves. It was the empire upon which the sun never set. Well, how in the heck did this happen? Well, it happened because back in 1100 AD, the son of William the Conqueror, his name was Henry I, got tired of the goldsmiths being in control of the national economy, because goldsmiths had discovered that by either lending out their gold coins plentifully or hoarding them and calling in their loans, they could manipulate the overall economy if they did so in concert, by colluding. And the average person in the economy never got it, that this was the collusion of the goldsmiths. They always blamed the political sovereign, in this case the king. And so King Henry got tired of this and decided he was going to put an end to it. So he issued his own national money, which was debt-free, and it completely served the public interest. They were called tally sticks. They were just simple sticks of wood that the king spent into existence. And it worked very well, and they were tally sticks were the prime form of money in England for some 700 years. And when the Bank of England finally got a charter from the British Parliament and started lending the British government money, they immediately took tally sticks out of circulation and started burning them, and they were burning so many of them, and the fire got so hot that it actually burned down the British Parliament building, and so it had to be rebuilt in the late 1700s.
Wow.
In any case, tally sticks worked very well, and that's the prime example. But there are many other examples of nations that have used debt-free government-issued money, and just as long as you control the quantity of the issuance and understand that that's what it's all about. It's not what backs the money that's important. What's important is who controls the quantity. If you truly believe that control of the quantity of a national money is the most important power of a sovereign nation, then you can easily control it, and your economy will be on a very solid footing, and it will thrive no matter what the conditions elsewhere in the world.
Tell us a little bit more about that and how that works, because I've always heard, we hear about fiat currency and we hear about, okay, it needs to be backed by something real, it needs to be based on gold for it to work, but that's what you're not saying that here, you're saying that it's about the who controls the quantity. How does that work?
Well, yeah, I mean, for example, here in the United States, the U.S. Treasury claims to have 248 million ounces of gold in Fort Knox. However, that's how I got into this story in the first place. I was running my newspaper, and an older gentleman called me one day and said, "Boy, have I got a story for you. There's no gold left in Fort Knox." And I just kind of rolled my eyes because I figured he was one of the crazy people that, you know, you get calls from all the time. But he sent me something in the mail, sent me a very thick packet of papers. And I became convinced that this guy was not crazy, that he knew what he was talking about. There were direct letters between he and the Secretary of the Treasury, the Director of the U.S. Mint, etc. And all he wanted was a very simple thing, and that was U.S. federal law calls for the gold reserves in Fort Knox to be audited, a physical audit, every year, annually. And yet one has not been done since 1955. And so immediately, you know, as a reporter, it became obvious that the government was hiding something. I had no idea what this was all about, and it took me about 10 years to figure it all out. But that's where I got my start. And the point is that if the U.S. government, for example, decided the solution to its problems would be a return to gold-backed money, well, there wouldn't be very much money, because I contend there's virtually no good deposit, 0.995 gold left in Fort Knox. If there was, they would surely have shown it to put to rest the fears of people like me over the years. So if we don't have any gold, what do you think would happen to the gold futures market as a gold money bill slowly marched its way through the American Congress? It would absolutely go through the roof as, you know, word leaked out that, you know, we might not have any gold left in Fort Knox. The exact same thing happened when in revolutionary America, the British government at one point, as a method of economic warfare, mandated that Americans had to pay all their taxes to the Brits back in gold. And of course, there was virtually no gold in America. And so this caused an instant and deep depression, and according to no less an authority than Benjamin Franklin, this was the core reason for the American Revolution, because The Brits took from America their homegrown paper money. So fiat money is typically used, especially in this day and age, not 50 or 100 years ago, but in this day and age, as a negative term. And it's not at all. It just means debt-free, government-issued money. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with it as long as you control the quantity. In fact, it is by far the most superior choice.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there any ideas where the gold is, if it indeed is missing? Has it been sold? I've heard rumors even that some of the gold bars around the world has been faked. That there's some kind of, they have a gold cover, but then it's something else inside, titanium or whatever it was. Any thoughts on that, Bill?
Yeah, it's tungsten.
Tungsten, yeah. That's right, yeah.
Put up in one of my still reports the first picture of an actual gold bar cut in half, and you can see the bluish tungsten rods that have been inserted. And you know, by volume, that gold bar is 40% tungsten at this point. Tungsten has the same density as gold, but of course it's a very cheap material. And so it's you're basically taking a 40% hit on your money if you happen to have a gold bar that's filled with tungsten. And hey, guess what? Since this word has leaked out, everybody around the world is not actually sawing into their gold bars to see if they're one of the unlucky ones that has a tungsten salted bar.
They're too scared to find out if that's the case, right?
I mean, why would you do that? You just want to kind of sell it and hope for the best.
What would you say about buying gold and everything? So, I mean, you hear that recommended all the time that it's a safe currency. It always has been. Are you of the same opinion?
Well, gold is not a currency, despite what people say, because currency implies that that it circulates without cost or with minimal cost, and of course, gold does not. Everybody, and just for no other reason what I just said, talked about, the tungsten salted bars, a gold coin, you can't go to your grocery store and buy groceries with it. You know, the grocer would have to have some way of assaying the coin to see if it's actually gold or is it just gold plated. So there's a cost of ownership, a cost of doing business, and it's not the most convenient form of currency. The most convenient form of currency, of course, is a debt-free government issued with appropriate anti-counterfeiting measures.
The tally stick, as you mentioned, in England, and then we had the colonial scrip as well in the U.S. after that. It seems that it's a constant battle, I guess, against the bankers and the conspirators behind the scenes, of people who try to counterfeit this currency. They try to destabilize it. Throughout history, it's a constant battle back and forth, and it doesn't seem to be anything you can do to protect yourself 100% to have a system in place that is operational and working that is going to last. Is that of your opinion as well?
Well, I mean, that's what I'm trying to do by, you know, I've devoted most of my adult life to this and putting up YouTubes and books and videos that will last hopefully long after I've passed away, to show people that it is a constant battle, and you can't just give over your freedom to someone. It's a continual struggle, and that's especially true on the monetary level, because money is the lubricant that greases all of commerce and really all of politics as well. So we have to inform our children, you know, that this is what's at stake. You cannot give the control over a national money system over to bankers. It has to be squarely in the hands of the elected officials. This is nothing less than a fight over self-determination, governments of self-determination, where we can elect the people who make the political decisions for us. There's a lot of people that talk bad about government right now, and I understand that. But the reason government is no longer as effective as it should be is because it has been bought by the very banker class that controls the money systems of virtually every nation on earth. And until we take that money power back into the hands of we the people through our elected officials, government isn't going to work for us, economics isn't going to work for us.
It seems interchangeable in these days anyway. When you talk about government or banks, or even you can put the corporations into the mix as well, and it's kind of uncertain of who owns who here. But it seems to me anyway, when you begin to scrape on the surface and look, it seems that the banks own the majority. And so I'm curious, and maybe you can let our listeners know as well how this works, Bill, that the relationship between the banks and the governments, and how the banks actually make money doing this by lending money to the governments.
Well, it's not that the banks make so much money lending money to governments. That's not the point at all. The point is, you know, it's even in the Bible that the borrower is servant to the lender. Once you can get a nation borrowing from you, if you're a bank, then you've got essentially control. It won't take long before you have effective, complete political control as well. That's what the problem is.
And so tell us a bit about fractional reserve banking and how the bank does this.
Yeah, well, that's one of the two big evils in the world. Banks are given permission by governments, given monopoly permission, essentially, to counterfeit the national money. Now, they don't do it by printing bills or minting coins. That would be way too obvious. But bills and coins are typically always less than 10% of the national money supply. The vast majority of a national money are computer digits, and in the offices of banks. Typically here in the United States, and the situation is even worse in Europe, but typically in the United States, banks are supposed to be held to a 10% reserve requirement. That means that they have to have 10% of cash of what they actually loan out. But what that means is that they get to create the 90% that they lend out literally out of nothing, backed by nothing, didn't exist before they lent it out. They just create it out of whole cloth. And the problem, the recent problem in 2008, the way it got out of control is just because there was really nobody enforcing this law on the banks in the United States. So instead of keeping a 10% reserve requirement, only lending out 9 times, then what happened was the large banks such as J.P. Morgan and Citibank were leveraged 52 to 1 instead of 9 to 1. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, which they're the big buyers of mortgage paper here in the United States, of real estate loans, they were leveraged 80 to 1. Goldman Sachs, through its derivatives, the best that we can tell, according to a congressional investigation in 2008, was leveraged 333 to 1. And now my understanding is that the big European banks are leveraged 100 to 1. So they're just creating money literally out of nothing and then having the gall to lend it to us at interest. And if we dare to miss a payment, then they'll quickly confiscate the collateral that they insisted upon backing their money, which is absolutely uncollateralized.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. Who would you put to blame her? Is it reasonable to also blame people who agree to these terms, to lend the money in these conditions? Or should there be options that you know, we ourselves create on the side, if that's even doable at this stage?
Well, yeah, it's doable. I mean, we're going to see a tremendous downturn once again. As the euro goes down, perhaps it'll be finally Germany giving up on Greece. Perhaps it'll be Spain or Portugal or Italy. But at some point, this Ponzi scheme is going to implode. And that's going to instantly ricochet around the world and be felt by everyone in every nation. At that point, it will become apparent that the solutions that have been offered by privately owned central bankers for the last century have not worked. And the population is going to insist on something new. And that's basically what I'm trying to prepare for, so that when that time comes, the bankers will, of course, offer a gold money system or a gold coin in addition to a basket full of additional currencies as backing for money or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And that's just their last standby, their last alternative to try to maintain their control over money, when we need to break their control over money entirely. National governments do not have to borrow. National governments, if they are truly sovereign, have the power to create their national money without debt in the public interest. That's the secret.
And so how do we explain this? Politicians in cahoots with the bankers who are just not following through on this? Do they not know how to do this? Where do we, how do we explain this?
That's a difficult question. You know, I've been working at it a long time, trying to reduce these concepts down, you know, as simply as I can, and still get the point across in a short enough time to so that people's attention span won't go away.
Right.
But you know, then that's their whole secret, is to try to make it so complex that people just give up. People live busy lives, and the bankers try to keep maintaining that, oh, this is way too complicated for you. You can't possibly understand it. Don't even try.
Right.
Just leave this stuff to us, the bankers, and, you know, we'll take care of it. Well, they're not taking care of it. All they're taking care of is getting giant handouts from their various sovereign nations and not passing on these handouts to bolster the economy for we the people. And this is going to become apparent, and people are going to become very upset. And that's the time when we have an opportunity to convince people that nations don't have to borrow. Banks don't have to be allowed to counterfeit the national money. If you just fix those two things, you've fixed 95% of the problem.
And the bankers are getting giant bonuses, and while the governments and the people behind the governments are giving money in bailouts to these bankers and getting nothing in return, it's amazing that this has happened. And we are now in 2012, and we have had demonstrations around the world, protests. I don't know if this is just my perception of the situation, but it's almost like it's even that is beginning to wind down and die down a little bit. Does it have to get even worse for people to wake up, do you think, Bill?
It has to get worse. And the problem is that right now in the United States, when I talk just among my family, you know, they'll kind of look at me funny and think, well, you know, but it's not so bad right now. You know, maybe the solutions they've been offering are going to work, and that's why we're not getting as much traction as we could. Now, I'll say, since I've been in this for 30 years, I've never gotten so much traction in my life. I mean, the numbers of people that are coming on board and understanding just what this scam is have grown by leaps and bounds, especially since the 2008 crash. So I'm very, very optimistic, but still we've got a long way to go. But as soon as the next crash comes, it's going to become obviously apparent to everybody that the solutions that have been offered have not worked.
All right. What about the solutions that they are going to offer as the fix for the problems that they've created? You know, if we look at it from that point of view, I've heard from many other people as well that are worried about this, and definitely understandable. When the bankers are creating the situation that we now currently are in, we are going to be offered with a solution that's going to entail, for instance, like a world bank, we have a world bank already, and of sorts, we have a world currency, the SDR, the special drawings rights of the IMF as well. But even on the purchasing level of, you know, everyday life for people as well, that we get a one world currency, and this would be maybe functioning for a little while. But eventually, this is also going to lead to more control of the bankers and further enslave people financially. What do you think about that, Bill?
Yes, it's absolutely true. What's at issue here is nothing less then will humanity be forced to return to a condition of serfdom? The whole march of the past 1,000 years of human history has been the march of the average person out of serfdom to where he can actually start to collect the fruits of his labors and provide for his family and have a little bit left over to create additional investments and additional businesses. That's the history of the last 1,000 years of human history, and that history has been characterized by the rise of self-determination, the rise of your ability to vote on representatives to make the political decisions for you, on your ability to run for office yourself. And, you know, this was just didn't exist 1,000 years ago. And so that's what's under attack, and they might not cancel all elections or do something that blatant, but in essence, for example, we have the two primary contenders here in the American presidential contest, Mr. Obama and Mr. Romney. The top 12 contributors to Mr. Obama's campaign are the biggest banks in the United States. Five of the top 6 contributors to Mr. Romney's campaign are the biggest banks. And so I guarantee you that as long as this system remains in place, there will be no effective legislation come out of the American Congress to try to deal with this problem. So it's going to take another big crash. People are going to have to understand that they've been had once again. And then and only then are we actually going to elect people into political office here in this country that will actually say, no, we're going to issue debt-free government-issued money, just as the United States has in its history so successfully. We're not going to allow bankers to be in control of the monetary system.
What about the, again, history, we look back, greenbacks, Lincoln, Kennedy tried to issue something similar, assassinations. It's a real threat, isn't it?
Well, just let me clear that up. That Kennedy thing, JFK, is an urban myth. Kennedy had no intention of issuing greenbacks or U.S. notes. I'm amazed this story continues to circulate. All you have to do is Google Executive Order 11101 or 11401 and a zero. And that's not what it says. It merely talks about transferring the authority to issue silver certificates over from the president to the Secretary of Treasury. And the reason they were doing that in that era, I believe it was 1963 when this was issued, was because the price of silver had risen so high that it was about to exceed the face value of the $1 bill. 1 ounce of silver was going above $1. And so they had to stop issuing silver certificates anyway. It had nothing to do with a conspiracy, nothing to do with Kennedy's assassination. Kennedy was assassinated because he messed with the CIA and the mafia in Cuba. And so they eventually got him.
Well, thank you for clearing that up for us. I'm going to link that up, the executive order. I think it's 4 ones and then a zero about the silver certificates. But Lincoln though, and the greenbacks, it's there though in the history. That's what I'm trying to say.
Lincoln was absolutely, in my opinion, assassinated by John Wilkes Booth, who, according to his own testimony, was the agent of international bankers. And there's nothing that you can do any more harmful to international bankers than to start having a government print its own money without debt and completely out of control of the bankers and completely in control of the national legislature. That's anathema to bankers.
What would you say would be some of the fixes here? I know I'm asking big questions of you, and these are major problems, and I know we're not expecting grandeur solutions to all of them. As you said, these are problems that many people are working on, that you've been working on for years as well. But your own personal opinion, I guess, we have a political system in the Eurozone, which is completely outside of voters. We didn't get a chance to vote for a president here. It was assigned for us. National sovereignty is not much to speak about anymore in the Eurozone either, because it's all run on the EU level these days. In America, you only have the two president choices, and never, it seems, like a third one would get in there. What do you encourage people to do? Is it to change the system from within, not voting at all, considering the quality of the candidates that people are given? Or how do you see this, Bill?
Well, that's a tough question, and to me, the only solution is monetary reform. Just in the words of William Jennings Bryan, who was the Democratic presidential nominee in 1896, he gave the most famous speech ever in American history on the floor of the Democratic Convention, called the Cross of Gold speech. And in that speech, he said that until monetary reform comes, no other effective reform is possible. And that's exactly my position as well. This is the most important issue in human history, the very basis of whether or not humanity will continue its march out of serfdom is at risk here. This is the very basis for most of the world's hunger, poverty, misery, and disease. And that's certainly enough to try to conquer in one lifetime.
There is a, I don't know if you've heard about this as well, it's the JAK Members Bank. It's a concept that arose in Denmark in 1931. It's moved on to Sweden, and it's basically interest-free loans, as far as I've understood it. I might simplify that too much. Have you heard about that, Bill?
Oh, yes. Yacht Bank is a wonderful initiative. I met with members of Yacht Bank when I was in Stockholm, and I'm still in touch with them, and that's a great alternative. I wouldn't say that it's interest-free, but to tell you the truth, I just don't remember exactly, so I would not want to be quoted. But at the very least, it's a rather complicated system, but they're not practicing fractional reserve lending. They're actually only lending out the money that their members have in the bank.
That's right. Now, the question as well is who can start a bank like this? Is if anybody can do it, or if there's certain procedures behind that? Because again, if we go back to history, I always find it curious that many of the elite families at the time, if we look at the example of Sweden, like the Wallenberg family, big financial family here, one of the predecessors just basically goes to Stockholm and starts a bank, which is like where the history begins, which has always been kind of suspicious to me. You have similar stories in coming out of Germany, of course, with Amschel Bayer, who changed name to Rothschild later, also just goes to Frankfurt and starts a bank there. Are these people who are assigned the job, do you think, to start a bank and to create this system? Because otherwise it seems kind of, I don't know, kind of fishy. To me, that they can just begin this enormous process of starting the bank system in these countries.
Well, it's an enormous process if you look back and tried to recreate it from scratch at this point, but it's not that difficult. And Jaak, I don't think, started out with a whole lot of capital to begin with. They just understood what the banking laws were and proceeded. Here in the United States, it's even simpler, I think, because we have a long our power is much more subdivided, non-centralized, because of the power of the various state governments. And so state governments can charter banks, state chartered banks. In fact, there were no nationally chartered banks until the middle 1800s. All banks previously were chartered by states, and so they can never get rid of that concept. And so here, for example, in North Dakota, we have a state that has chartered its own bank for its own use, to use state money strictly in the public interest. And it's worked great. It's been going for 100 years in North Dakota. And any state can do this. And that's why North Dakota is the state with the lowest unemployment, the state that always balances its budget, the state with the highest birth rate. And yet it's one of the smallest states. It only has 600,000 people in the entire state. So it's the shining light. And we're working very hard to convince other state governments to take a look at the North Dakota model and start their own state banks. And what that does is it the state can lend itself money. The state doesn't have to go to the big New York banks and create bonds have large projects. So it just saves the state a lot of money and allows the state to use its resources in the public interest instead of just turning it over to the large New York banks.
And is it then just a question of getting as many people as possible within the state to begin to put their money into this bank, to starting to bank with these banks that does it right, basically?
Well, yeah, you can do it that way. You can have private depositors, or you can just have it strictly for the state's own use. Either way, there are models for it to work. But the idea is that money must serve the public interest. Governments must start using their money to serve the public interest instead of thinking they just have to give all of their money over to big New York banks and, you know, let them do whatever they want to do. And you don't, in the United States, you don't even have to be a state government to have your own bank charter. You can have smaller, like universities could have their own university banks, or towns could have their own town banks. This movement is really just starting, and I believe at the very start of 2013, which is when most of the state governments have their legislative sessions, you're going to see quite a few start to opt for funding study commissions to study the North Dakota model, and that'll really be a great day.
So we could maybe get a situation where the whole monetary system doesn't first collapse and then people begin to look at alternatives, but slowly begin to migrate over to something, hopefully.
Yeah, that's right, and that is the hope, and we'll see what happens. But there are a lot of people working on the state bank problem. I sit a little bit off to the side, and I tend to deal with the whole thing, but Ellen Brown, for one, is really at the very center of that state bank movement.
Indeed, we've had Ellen with us before. She does excellent work, and her book, Web of Debt, of course. Now, what do you think in the U.S. about credit unions? Is this good options? Again, does it matter if they're using the same bank currency, though, after all?
There is not really bank currency. There are bank electronic digits. Credit unions basically don't practice fractional reserve lending. So, yeah, they're a good alternative, but they don't make that much profit. And so you really have to find people who want to have money serve the public interest more than just maximize their profits, and that's difficult.
Yeah, and well, it seems to me in a way that it's just we're dealing with an artificial system here. It's not based on anything. It is belief-based. We consider the aspects of the Glass-Steagall Act when that was repelled. Was it back in 1998, I think it was, in any regard, or 99, Bill Clinton did it. And what happened there, basically, because the whole monetary system, the financial system, has been turned into a major casino, and they're gambling with people's money, and everybody wants to make more money on the money that's there already. Is it possible to have a system that you make money on by just having the money in, you know, placed somewhere? Is that a viable option? Is that something that actually works, in your opinion, Bill?
Well, yeah, it is, but you have to have strict legal requirements and have those enforced to prevent people from creating too much money. And it's going to take a whole mindset change, and that change is just, you're not going to have, it's called political will. You're not going to have the political will for the general population to really understand that it's this fractional reserve lending system combined with the ability of governments to borrow at all that is the core of the problem. When governments can borrow, they don't have to balance their budgets. They can continue to spend wildly because the borrowing is something that is down the road. And, well, when we get to repaying, we'll just borrow some more and borrow some more. It's called rolling over your debts. And that's the very thing that these big commercial banks love. They love to have corporations and governments to the point where they can't even pay the interest on their debt, but their debts have to be rolled over because then they really have them in their clutches. And the governments or the corporations have to do exactly what the banks say.
In the next segment here, I want to talk more about the Federal Reserve System. And as you mentioned, you're making a film about this as well, upcoming currently. Before we go there, though, let's talk a little bit about the things you do have out there. I mentioned The Money Masters. I think it's your first film, and then The Secrets of Oz, of course. Give out your website addresses, Bill, so people know where to go to pick up copies of these and how we can buy them. Is it online? Is it DVD format? Tell us about that.
It's a DVD format, and there's even a Swedish translation now. You can get it at www.billstill.com.
Excellent. Billstill.com. We're going to have this linked up, of course, and I encourage you to do take a look at this because it's excellent material on the background of the monetary system. As we've been talking about here, we just kind of scraped the surface so far in this first segment, but we'll carry on and talk more in the second. So stay with us. We'll be returning here shortly. If you're in Scandinavia or close, don't miss Bill Still at the Open Mind Conference in Skanderborg, Denmark, on the 20th to the 22nd of September. OpenMindConference.com has more information and a full list of speakers. A lot of good speakers there as well. So kudos to our Danish friends who are putting that on. OpenMindConference.com. We're going to continue with Bill Still in the second hour to discuss how the financial system is being run to benefit those who regulate and control it. We discuss the wonderful Wizard of Oz book, and Bill argues that the symbolism that Frank Baum incorporated into the story alludes to the monetary system. We also discuss Iceland, Greece, austerity measures, and the future of the euro. What happened to the bailout money, and how can a nation escape the clutches of the IMF, BIS, and the WTO? More coming up in the second hour. Go to redicemembers.com and click on subscribe to sign up and acquire a membership to continue to listen to this or any of our previous programs. We spare you from commercial breaks, and so if you like what we do, please consider signing up for a membership. And again, a note for our members. If you're listening to the first hour through redicecreations.com, you're in the wrong place. So go to redicemembers.com from now on when a new program is released, and you'll have both hours right there on one page, much easier. And also, by the way, an excellent way to get notifications when a new program is up is to subscribe to the RSS feed with our latest programs. This way, you don't even have to click into the site. It'll come right to you in iTunes, Downcast, or whatever program or app that you use to read the RSS feed. Just make sure that you use a program or an app that can accept your login details and display the downloadable files, of course. All right, that's that. Just a quick note on upcoming guests on Red Ice Radio: Mark Grant, Randall Carlson, Freeman and Jamie, Charles Upton, Santos Bonacci, Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, and many more. We'll talk to you after the break.